Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Dr. Mark Rowlands, the chair of philosophy at the University of Miami, has written a new book, The Word of Dog, what our canine companions can teach us about living a good life. And we'll visit with Dr. Rowlands. But we open today's Main Street on this inauguration day with a Conversations on Healthcare. Hosts Margaret Flitner and Mark Maselli welcome Erica Franklin. She's the co-director of the Wesleyan Project, and she joins the host to analyze the $4.5 billion spent on political ads this election season.
Dr. Franklin Fowler, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Now, I noted in your most recent report, and I say recent report because I know this gets updated pretty regularly, but it showed some interesting data points. 18% of all the ads were focused in on healthcare. 28% of them were pro-Democratic and only 7% pro-Republican. And 10% of all ads were about abortion. 20% were pro-Democratic, and the Republican ran zero ads on the topic. I'm wondering if you could share with our audience, what does this tell us right now?
Yeah, I think it tells us that healthcare broadly is not polarized. I think both parties care about it, but certainly abortion specifically is a very polarizing topic, and Democrats are talking a lot about it, and Republicans really don't know how to message on that particular issue at the moment.
Well, Erica, we're all living in Connecticut, you and Mark and myself, and your chart shows our media market only aired 21 presidential ads in total in mid-October, compared to Philadelphia, which had 36,000 ads in the weeks before Election Day. So for those who did not see the healthcare spots, what messages were they sending about abortion, prescription drugs, and healthcare for the undocumented people?
So you support giving universal health care, Medicare for all, to people who are in this country illegally?
I am opposed to any policy that would deny in our country any human being public health, period.
Are you for defunding the police?
How are you defining defund the police?
It's actually wrong and backward to think that more police officers will create more safety.
We need to get rid of money bail.
Convicted, in prison, like the Boston Marathon bomber, on death row, people who are convicted of sexual assault, they should be able to vote?
I think we should have that conversation.
I am prepared to get rid of the filibuster to pass a Green New Deal.
I have always supported Medicare for all. I was very happy to sign on to Bernie's bill, and I give Bernie, frankly, a lot of credit.
There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking.
Do you ban plastic straws?
I think we should.
Yeah, so very different sets of messaging. And I can also describe how the messaging has changed over time, if that's useful. But for residents of Connecticut, we didn't get a lot of presidential ads. What we saw were essentially the national buys. So when either presidential candidate purchased an ad that aired everywhere, basically, whereas residents of battleground states were getting inundated with a ton of advertising, not just on television, but also on their mobile devices, at the gas pump, you know, anywhere they have a screen. The healthcare messaging this year, there was a lot about cost. Specifically, that about lowering cost. And so maybe not surprisingly, you have partisans of both sides of the aisle attacking the other for high costs related. That also relates to economic considerations and inflation, of course, but there was a lot of discussion of healthcare costs specifically, and then some discussion of Medicare premiums as well going up. I think Donald Trump aired some ads attacking the Harris campaign for increasing Medicare premiums specifically. On the abortion side, there was obviously a lot of Democratic messaging about concerns over women's rights. The Republican candidates up and down the ballot supporting national abortion bans and or taking away women's reproductive freedoms. So those, I think, were the main topics. With respect to immigration, there was a ton of messaging on that this year. A lot of it, the healthcare related conversation within it was about fentanyl and fentanyl coming across the border and securing the border that way, which is very different than the prior messaging that we used to see on opioids and concerns over opioid use.
Well, certainly in the mix of all of those ads and perhaps the TV spot getting the most attention is President Trump's anti-trans ad the so-called they-them ad.
Supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
It's hard to believe, but it's true. Even the liberal media was shocked Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and illegal aliens.
Every transgender inmate would have access.
Kamala's for they-them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
There are reports that the Trump campaign and others spent over $120 million airing this ad, oftentimes during football games. I wonder if you could tell us about the commercial and its impact.
Yeah, it also aired a lot during the World Series. And so, and so definitely it was a very prominent spot. It got a lot of free media attention, not just the paid advertising that the Republican campaign spent on it. I think one important thing to note, too, is that it echoes lines of attack that are not just in the presidential race. There are other Republican candidates further down the ballot, specifically in House races, but I think there are even where some in Senate races that used transgender issues to make similar lines of attack against Democratic candidates, basically saying, you know, the Democratic candidate is for they, them, and we are for you. In most cases, those ads go after transgender surgeries and support for transgender surgeries. The language is something along the lines of, from the Republican perspective, is something about we're protecting children from, you know, life-altering transgender surgeries. But it also leans sometimes also into biological men being in women's bathrooms and women's sports, and so you find sort of a combination of one of those three, sometimes all three in Republican messaging. And that is definitely a topic. We saw some of these attacks in the 2022 cycle from Republicans. Democrats mostly do not talk about this issue. They didn't talk about it in 2022, and they didn't do it again in 2024.
Well, you know, it's so interesting around healthcare. There's healthcare and there's healthcare coverage, right? And we go back to the memorable 2008 campaigns, the Affordable Care Act, you know, the 12 and 16 repeal, replace, now enjoying unprecedented popularity as a part of the American healthcare system. But I don't think I ever saw that in the polling or in the ads that were out there. It seems like for both protecting it, the Democrats would have put more emphasis on it, and the Republicans, you know, continue to kind of shy away now from repeal, but saying they're going to make everything better. What did you see happening within this domain in terms of healthcare coverage and the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is an issue that we've tracked extensively over time because some of our first analyses were tracking the Affordable Care Act. What's interesting, so Democrats, after they passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, sort of ran away from the issue. They didn't talk about it for basically a decade. The Republican messaging on healthcare was much more prominent in the early, 2012, 2004, 2016, and it was all about repeal and replace. It wasn't until the 2018 cycle when Republicans had tried, right, to repeal the act, and turns out that a lot of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act are very popular, mm-hmm. that Democrats finally found, oh, okay, perhaps we should come back and talk about pre-existing conditions and other sorts of things. And so we had, the Wesley Media Project actually had dubbed the 2018 election as the healthcare election because there was such a prominent focus from both parties on healthcare, because Republicans couldn't run away from it entirely. They were trying to defend their votes and defend, you know, like say that they were for pre-existing, you know, protecting pre-existing conditions and other things. We sort of expected 2020 to be another healthcare election. COVID, obviously, although it was clearly a health pandemic, had an interesting interaction in that because there was so much economic disaster that occurred that it was both healthcare and the economy sort of shared the advertising attention that year. And then, of course, the Dobbs decision has sort of shifted the healthcare landscape to talking more about abortion. I would say that, you know, I think abortion restrictions are very unpopular. I mean, there's a lot about healthcare that works in Democrats' favor because of the popularity of a lot of different types of provisions. And what's interesting this cycle is you had a lot of abortion amendments passing in states and even some really conservative states that also went for Trump. Right. And I don't know if that is potentially indicative of residents sort of buying the Republican line of argument. Trump actually said this explicitly, you know, like, well, I sent it back to the states. And so there may be some indications that the population thinks that making, you know, amendments to their state constitutions will protect them from potential abortion bans. Whether or not that pans out is to be determined.
Well, it has in a couple of very conservative states. And so maybe they got the idea that it was coming to them, might be ill-formed. And, you know, I want to go back to your earlier answer about the efficacy of ads. And I noted the New York Times carried a piece before the election day that said Democrats won the ad war in terms of dollars spent since they lost. I think you've already sort of opined a little bit about the effectiveness of TV ads. Is it over or diminishing? But I guess I'd also like to know, if you had to spend money, would you spend it on advertisement or get out the vote campaign? I mean, is there... Have you looked at, you know, what's the best investment that one could make in a campaign?
Yeah, all good questions. I mean, I think a campaign has to do all of the above, right? So since we've been tracking television advertising, which, you know, the Wesley Media Project started in 2010, we have data that go back a decade earlier than that. To 2000. But since 2010, every cycle, everyone has predicted, you know, is this the year that television ends? And we really still, I mean, even this cycle, although it's not a historically high year for television, because 2020, when folks couldn't campaign in other ways, television sucked in a lot of that additional funding. Television is still important. It's still an important way to reach mass audiences, and especially older Americans who are more likely to turn out. But the television advertising is really for the persuasion public. It's not, there are some get out the vote ads, but they're mostly to try to persuade the undecideds. That doesn't replace your sort of campaign strategy to also try to mobilize the base. And so digital advertising, actually, which has seen really large increases, especially this cycle, the Harris campaign, we haven't totaled all the dollars yet, but early in the cycle, they came up and said, you know, that they were already committing $480 million to digital and streaming, which is, you know, that was mind blowing. And they definitely had advantages, especially on the Meta properties. So Facebook and Instagram relative to the Trump campaign, Google and YouTube, it was tighter, but they also had advantages there. The advertising that happens online there are two purposes. So some of it is traditional persuasion that looks like more like what you would see on television, but then there also are donation appeals, trying to get people to they're trying to raise money so that they can spend more on advertising. And then there also are get out the vote, advertising at the end. But the get out the vote is also going to be through door knocking and, you know, phone calls and other sorts of things. I think campaigns ignore one of those strategies, persuasion or mobilization, at their peril. So they're going to do both. And so I think the answer is more of all, right? So part of the reason why we see increasing amounts of money going to elections is because there are increasing number of platforms and ways to try to reach citizens, and campaigns try to do more and more of all of those things.
Well, we can only imagine the media industry was very happy with the elections just for the sheer volume of business. But Eric, I want to give you a moment to perhaps go a little bit hyper-local and generational. There are lots of polls and a lot of feedback about how young people were voting. You're on the campus of Wesleyan University here in Middletown, Connecticut. You're surrounded by young people, probably have a few work-study students with you to analyze data.
Sure.
And a lot of engagement with faculty. What did you hear from young people relative to the election, and how did it stand in contrast or similarity to what the national polls were saying?
Yeah, so, I mean, our campus and President Michael Roth here is really been pushing democracy initiatives, trying to, you know, like reach our constituencies here and ensure that they're engaged in democratic practice and all of those things. And so I think, you know, the Wesleyan student body tends to be pretty politically active generally. I do think this cycle, you know, speaking about the headwinds, was challenging for young voters for lots of reasons. I think there are a lot of young people who are concerned about democracy and concerns about democratic backsliding. I think there also are a lot of, you know, concerns about the war in Gaza and what is happening there. And that has implications for the Biden administration and the Harris campaign, frankly, because of their involvement in the activities over there. And so I see a lot of different, you know, students in my classes would be students who are already sort of very interested in politics. Hearing from some of them, you know, I think there's a varying interest in politics. There is some level of disengagement, I think, more mm-hmm. broadly among the youth population, in part because the politicians of both parties have historically been so aging. That dynamic shifted, I think, when Harris entered the race, but maybe isn't completely replaced, in part because, you know, there still are a lot of issues that aren't necessarily being talked about that are really important to younger voters, including climate, for example, right, that doesn't get maybe enough attention.
You know, I want to connect the dots here. You were talking a little bit earlier about the million spent on digital ads and then sort of where young people are. And this was also an election about podcast, right? So you had Trump really very focused in on the Joe Rogan experience, and he was on 6 Feet Under and this past weekend with A.O. Van and others. And I'm wondering how you're sort of dealing, how this has come into, this is a sort of new experience or a new data point for elections, right? Where there was a real strategy on the Trump campaign to make sure, now Harris got out to a few places, but really not the depth that it seemed that President Trump was engaged in. How are you assessing the impact there of these broadcasts that were out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think notably the Harris campaign went on Call Her Daddy, right, which was another one of those that has a large audience, notably a female audience, right, in contrast to the Rogan experience. I think so those types of events are there has always been a strategy of presidential campaigns finding innovative ways to try to talk to voters. So if we go back to the 1990s, for example, there's a reason why Bill Clinton took his saxophone and went on late night TV.
Sure.
Right. So the campaigns are looking for audiences. Most Americans, and this is true across the board, and in fact, it's one of the things I say to all of my media and politics students the first time that they show up, is I say, by definition of you being here, you're not the average American. Most Americans tune politics out, frankly. It's not that they're not interested. It's just that their lives are busy and it's not, you know, top of mind and top priority for them necessarily. And so campaigns know this, and they have always, you know, sort of going back to the innovation of modern campaign and modern campaigning, are always looking for new and different ways to try to reach voters in places where they might not always hear from politicians. And so I would say that both the phenomenon of the podcasts and going on podcasts it's a new tactic, but it's an old, you know, like strategy of campaigns. And
but is it the engagement there? I mean, you get the shout outs, you know, the tweets by Taylor Swift or Beyonce, but these podcasts are really about a long conversation with people over a wide range of topics versus just, hey, I've got celebrities lined up and they're doing, you know, a one-off for me. But the podcasts seem to have more texture, engagement, drawing people in, which is their job, right? Because they're looking to have an audience and a meaningful one. So, you know, it does seem to be a somewhat of a shift here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a different format, and certainly a longer format allows politicians both to, you know, like convey to citizens that they are more normable, maybe, than they—
Because they're talking about sports, they're talking about other things. They're not just talking about, hey, I'm here to give you my spiel and, you know—
Right, exactly. And I think that is in line with, campaigns that have gone to entertainment, entertainment leaning programs to include late night TV, but also, you know, daytime talk shows and other sorts of things. Those strategies are always beneficial to a campaign because it shows a different side of the candidate than you would get through a more formal setting. So, yeah, I mean, I think the exposure that candidates get from those settings can be really important. And you're right that the longer format and the way in which some of those, the three hour conversation in particular, enables a much lengthier look at a candidate than most citizens get in any other format.
Well, Erica, the election is behind us, and that means it must be ready for the midterm elections, right?
Get very little break, unfortunately.
Coming right up, very little break. And I'm curious, as we look forward, and based on some of the comments to the degree to which people tuned out much of the political ads of this of the presidential election, I'm wondering whether there is a strategy to maybe put forward some of the younger members of the administration, and certainly some of the people proposed for high profile posts or that the president says he'll appoint are not shy about being on camera, have a long history of being in the public eye. Do you think there'll be more use of people in other positions in political ads than just an aging president going forward for the midterms?
Yeah, for sure. And I do think, already if you watch as many ads as we end up watching, and there are thousands of them on television, and then, many, many, many more on digital, they do often feature younger people just by their nature. They're trying to, convey to a wide variety of residents that, the candidate is for people like them by featuring people like them. So definitely, I think that will continue to be a strategy. And then the other one big feature that both campaigns use is bringing on, your model citizen to convey, support from a particular constituency. So in the context of healthcare, that can often mean doctors and nurses are showing up in advertising to convey their support for a particular candidate or their concern about a particular problem that's not being addressed. And both of those things can be effective too in terms of conveying what is at stake, basically.
That's interesting. Maybe individual providers are resonating, but if you look at the institutional view of the CDC, of the Department of HHS and the like, those are really underwater significantly. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the public health, how are we going to get very important health messages across to people when there's been such an undermining of the traditional go-to healthcare organizations that are steeped in science, and yet people are saying, not going there, not believing them.
It is a real challenge. And that is something I work with a collaborative on media and messaging for health and social policy. And this is something that we care deeply about, because the polarization and politicization of health related messaging has tremendous and important and sometimes life altering consequences. And so I do think it is really important for us to be thinking about how, medical and public health and CDC level guidance is perceived and taken in, and how do we communicate about those topics in ways that build back up trust is super important. So thinking, I think, first about leading first and foremost with values, and I do think that individual messengers can be more important and helpful than the institutions themselves. It's important that the institutions are trusted too, but part of the way that we can get there or sort of try to build back is about the messenger and about the sort of leading with values. Like, we all care about health of society and health of our children and those sorts of things. And I think leading with messages like that are super important.
Well, Erica, you mentioned the Collaborative on Media and Messaging for Health and Social Policy. We'd love to have you take a minute to talk a little bit more specifically about your work on advancing health and racial equity. Tell us what you're doing in that area.
Yeah, so the Collaborative is a three-institution organization. So we have Wesleyan is part of it. We sort of direct the media tracking hub. We also work with researchers at Cornell University that lead the sort of media impact hub, and they do messaging experiments and tests and other things. And then the University of Minnesota hub is our dissemination and engagement. So between the three institutions, we've done a fair amount of work, both talking and listening to healthcare communicators and health communicators more broadly about what are the challenges that they have seen and what are they facing in this more polarized and politicized climate. And some of the questions that have been asked in that setting are about, you know, do we talk about health equity? Do we talk about race? Do we talk about, you know, these different issues, and how do talking about any of those things affect the perceptions and the impact of the messaging that we put forward? And then once we, you know, have gathered that information from the practitioners on the ground, our goal is to take that back and try to work on messaging that can help move policy forward in a productive way. So what we've been working, some of my colleagues have been working on messaging about the child tax credit. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that is, it has been super beneficial of lifting people out of poverty. And one of the questions is, you know, can we talk about the child tax credit in a way that specifies who the beneficiaries are, mm-hmm. without a sort of a backlash effect from other citizens? And it, at least the preliminary evidence suggests that, yes, there is a way that we can talk both about the universal benefits, but also the targeted benefits of the policy without backlash. And so those types of research evidence, I think, can be helpful in bringing back evidence to the people on the ground about how to talk about policy in ways that improve and increase support for policies that we know improve health and racial equity.
Thank you, Erica, for joining us. And thanks to our audience for being here.
Coming after the break, Dr. Mark Rowlands has written a new book. It's called The Word of Dog: What Our Canine Companions Can Teach Us About Living a Good Life. He explores the philosophical insights we can gain from dogs. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Mark Rowlands has a strong academic background in philosophy and holds a PhD in philosophy from Oxford University, and he's currently the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Miami. His latest book is The Word of Dog: What Our Canine Companions Can Teach Us About Living a Good Life. Dr. Rowlands, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Rowlands, your book explores the idea that dogs lead more meaningful lives maybe than humans. What inspired you to delve into this philosophical perspective?
Every morning and afternoon, I walk my dog Shadow. He's a German Shepherd, an East German working line Shepherd. We walk on the canal that runs behind our house. And entering the banks of the canal, scores and scores of iguanas of various sorts. And so when I let Shadow off the leash, he will shoot off in a sort of northerly direction first. The iguanas who are lying on the bank will then peel off, jump into the water, swim to the other side, where they'll stay for the rest of the day. And then he repeats this in a sort of southerly direction. And as a result of his efforts, the far bank of the canal is just lined up with iguanas, where they, as I say, will stay for the rest of the day. But nighttime, it seems, is a time of forgetting for iguanas. And the next morning, they'll be back on our side, and Shadow will begin his efforts all over again. So it struck me, eventually, wheels turn slowly sometimes, but eventually it struck me that this is a bit like the myth of Sisyphus. Now, Sisyphus was a figure in Greek mythology. He offended the gods, and they devised this punishment for him, which involved him rolling a large rock up a hill. When he gets to the top, the rock rolls back down to the bottom, and he has to begin all over again. In philosophical discussions of things like the meaning of life, Sisyphus featured quite prominently in two different ways. First, his existence is taken as the sort of the epitome of that meaningless existence. He just had repetitive activity, the only result of which is a continuation of this activity. So that's one thread, the meaningless existence thread. The other is that he's often taken to be an allegory of human life. You know, we fight our way to work in the morning. We spend 8 hours or so doing various things with probably modest results, and we fight our way home. That's waiting for us home, waiting for us at home with children. That's not, but if there are, then they may well grow up and do the same thing as we did, or more or less the same thing, just mere notational variants on what we do. And so the challenge posed by Sisyphus is that, first of all, Sisyphus's life is meaningless, and secondly, our lives are recognizably Sisyphean. It struck me that Shadow had, without understanding that there was a problem there or anything like that, he had somehow solved this problem. Because my intuition was that this exiling the iguanas, having them return, doing the same thing the next day over and over again, this was the most meaningful part of Shadow's day. And so I started looking at why this would be. Why is there this difference between Shadow and us? And so that what would and as horrendously meaningless for us as inherently meaningful for him. And basically, that's what the book is about.
You argue that creatures of doubt are us, humans, while dogs are more creatures of commitment. How does that distinction challenge, I guess, traditional philosophical views of morality and meaning?
I think we're creatures of doubt in this sense, and I think that this is at the heart of the difference between Shadow and me, for example, as a representative human. We're creatures of doubt because we have this ability that dogs don't have, or they have only in very small or vestigial form, the ability to reflect on a reflection is the ability to think about yourself, about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And we do this all the time. Dogs hardly do it at all, if at all. And once you have this ability, then you become what we might think of as a troubled creature. So you believe something. And then, but now, because of this ability to reflect on what you believe, you go, oh, should I believe this? There are good reasons not to believe it. What will other people think of me if I believe it? And so our belief, because of this ability to reflect, it becomes what we might think of as a troubled belief. And a creature with troubled beliefs and troubled mental states, more generally, is a troubled creature. So I don't think this sort of contravenes any general philosophical theories about the nature of humans. I mean, you find in the history of philosophy some. I mean, there's an emphasis on certainty. You know, when modern philosophy was born in the hands of René Descartes, his major concern was certainty. What can we be certain of? Perhaps this sort of this emphasis on certainty is a kind of passive reflection of the idea of being troubled creatures who are never really certain of anything. So to contrast this troubled nature of us with the sort of commitment of dogs, which I think is very very different.
The book we're discussing is The Word of Dog, What Our Canine Companions Can Teach Us About Living a Good Life. Its author is Mark Rowlands, and he is joining us today on Main Street. Dr. Rowlands, we have spoke often about empathy on this show and over this air, and as a key ethical achievement, contrasted with scrutiny. How can humans, I guess, learn from the way dogs exhibit empathy? What is it that we should know?
Well, there's a sort of standard picture of morality. It's the sort of thing we're supposed to do as humans. And what we're supposed to do is sort of critically scrutinize our motivation. So I'm inclined to do this, whatever this is. Is this something I should act on? Or is this something I should embrace? Or is this something I should resist? And the kind of picture of morality is involving motivations that you critically scrutinize and assess in the light of your preferred moral principles. That's the way people have often thought that that's the way in which humans are supposed to be moral in the eyes of many. I think it's pretty clear that all animals don't do that sort of thing. But they're moral in a very sort of different sense. And in many ways, I think it's a better sense. They're moral in the sense that they have emotions which are about welfare of others. So, you know, you look at any, well, say a brief internet search is always very instructive. I mean, type in, for example, dog saves dog in Chile. What you will be taken to is a scene of very busy road in Chile. One dog has been hit by a vehicle and lies motionless in the middle of the road. another dog at an enormous risk to itself weaves its way in and out of the traffic and eventually manages to drag the dog to the side of the road. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the dog didn't subject its motivations to critical scrutiny. It didn't think things like, well, I'm inclined to go and save this other dog here. Is this something I should embrace or is this something I should resist? It acted on a much more sort of visceral capacity for empathy or fellow feeling with the other dog. I think when animals are moral, they're moral in that sense. There's a tradition in moral philosophy associated with the philosopher David Hume, which sees empathy or sentiment as central to morality. And I think whether or not it's central to human morality, though I suspect it is, but whether or not it is, it's certainly central to the morality of dogs.
When I think about dogs, Dr. Rollins, I think about love. And we had one dog when our kids were growing up, Barney. He was a Cocker Spaniel. Our daughter has had one dog in the last 10 years or so. It's Joni, and she's kind of a mix. Our son has had one dog. His name is Ace. We call him the Wonder Dog, and we love him. We just love them. And I want to ask you about this. Iris Murdoch's notion that love is recognizing something other than oneself resonates deeply, I think, in your depiction of dogs. How do dogs embody this realization, maybe better than humans?
I think dogs are very, very good at empathy. I was struck by this when I first became a father at the ripe old age of 44, when I was a bit worried. We had two dogs at the time. There was Tess, who was a wolf dog mix, and Nina, who was a rather ferocious German Shepherd Mummy. A little worried about how the co-sharing arrangements were going to work, but they turned out to be, you know, better parents than I was in many ways. You know, if my son so much as squeaked in the middle of the night, I'd have these two cold noses pressed up against my face. You know, wake up, be negligent, father, your son needs you. this sort of empathy, I think it comes naturally to dogs in a way, perhaps, but it doesn't come naturally to we.
Also talk about that dogs possess a form of freedom and agency, and I'd like you to elaborate perhaps a little bit on how you define those concepts in the canine context.
Yes, I think the only way of doing it really is by comparison with the human context. And so my conception of freedom has been shaped by work in the phenomenological tradition in philosophy. And so when I think of freedom, I think of freedom as something like the way Jean-Paul Sartre does, where you have a motive to do something, and precisely because you're aware of this motive, it can't make you do anything at all. What makes you aware of your motive is reflection. And so once you can reflect on your motive, they become inert. They become incapable of moving you. So this can be a good thing as well as a bad thing. The way Sartre puts it, because he was a bit like this, but the way Sartre puts it sounds awful. But in fact, it can be a good thing too. I mean, I remember running my first marathon in a severely undertrained state, and the experiential unpleasantness gradually got worse and worse. But somewhere around the 15-mile mark, I realized, well, it can't actually make me stop. It cannot. It doesn't have any authority over me. So the freedom of humans is the realization that you your motives cannot compel you. They cannot make you do a thing in the end, which is it's a combination of well, I think it's largely terrifying, actually. But when Sartre talks of this, he talks about the case of the gambler who has built up over a period of years or decades all these resolutions against gambling, but then realizes in what Sartre calls anguish, these resolutions cannot help him at all. And he feels them melt away as he approaches the gaming table. So freedom for humans is the realization that no motivation, no resolution you've created can ever in the end make you do anything at all. I think freedom for dogs is more like the freedom that Spinoza talked about when he talked about things acting through the necessity of their own nature. I see the shadow do this every day on the canal bank, where he just explodes into action, disappears into the distance, spreading iguanas or winds. And that kind of freedom is he's doing something he has to do, and that's him is, I think for any dog, is what freedom is.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Mark Rollins. He has a PhD in philosophy from Oxford University and is currently the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Miami. His latest book is The Word of Dog, What Our Canine Companions Can Teach Us About Living a Good Life. Dr. Rollins, what's the neatest thing your dogs have taught you?
It's difficult to pin down one. I think what counts as neatest depends on where you are in your life. You know, so I was struck by something that happened to Shadow recently and something he did in response. Because I've talked about him charging up and down the canal. This is, and I've been talking about it as if it's in the present tense. But he actually, about 9 months ago, in April of last year, had a stroke, a spinal embolism. And a bit of cartilage or something like that got into the blood supply in his spine. And as a result, he was paralyzed in his back leg. This lasted maybe 5 minutes before the movement started coming back. And it was a long week. But there's something he did when this happened, which just kind of struck me. The sun was out. This is April in Miami. The sun is pretty brutal. He doesn't like it at all. So what he did was use his front legs to crawl into the shade. He wouldn't let me anywhere near him, but he used his front legs to crawl into the shade. And I thought this is a fantastic example of just taking each thing as it comes. You know, when you get to a certain age, you realize that you know, life has certain things in store for you, and they're not particularly good, and this can be overwhelming in some respects. And this sort of this idea of just take each thing as it comes and don't look too far into the future. I think that's something I probably needed to hear.
Sounds like words I could live by as well, Dr. Rowland. Who's your book written for? Who's the intended audience for your book?
You know, that's a really good question. It's probably something I don't think about it when I write books. I just find myself sitting down and writing things, and sometimes they end up as books and sometimes they don't. What I would say is I think if you want to, for anyone who loves dogs and is interested in understanding their dog and in understanding how listening to their dog and help them with their own lives, then that would probably be the kind of audience that the book is not intended for, but ended up for.
You critique humanity's tendency, I'll say, to view itself as superior to other species. We are the superior beings. What do you believe humans can gain by letting go of that mindset in context of your book?
Well, if you think you're superior, we're followed sort of by a period, you know, there's just superior, you're either superior or you're not. If you think in those terms, then you're not going to be open to what other creatures can teach you. But if you recognize that superiority is never followed by a period, there's always some kind of superiority in some respect or other. That existence is like that. It's always a game of sort of swings and roundabouts. What you gain in certain respects, you lose in other respects. So given the way we humans have developed, we've done amazing things, and there's no shortage of human beings who are quite willing to write about how great we are. But we've also lost certain things, and these things we might be able to find again in some form or in some faint echo, maybe, by looking at our dogs and understanding what they have and we don't.
I found the book somewhat conversational, but you're not afraid to dive into complex philosophical ideas, I guess I'll say. Was it hard for you to balance the philosophical rigor with accessibility for readers who may not have a philosophical background, Dr. Rollins?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I enjoy writing like that because I think it's writing in many ways for that audience is the acid test of whether you really understand something. If you understand something and you understand it properly, then you can explain it to not everyone maybe, but a lot of people and maybe most people.
What's next, Dr. Rollins?
Well, I have, at the end of this year, I have a book coming out on topic of memory. As you get older, memory becomes a lot of, and you realize there's more of your life behind you than is in front of you, then memory becomes more important. And around about the same time, you realize just what a fallible faculty it is. Extraordinarily interesting as well as fallible. So I've written something about that, but I'm also thinking about various other projects, some of which will involve.
Have your students given you any feedback from this book that we're talking about today, The Word of Dog?
You know, I don't really think I've taught it yet. I saw little bits of it maybe in a class I did a couple of years ago, but not much. So no, I'll look forward to whatever feedback I get.
As we kind of wind up our conversation today, Dr. Rollins, I'm very curious about the idea of instinct and canines and dogs? And do you believe their general life are guided by instinct or what they learn for a deeper moral reasoning, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, as in all cases of nature and nurture, where instinct corresponds to nature and learning corresponds to nurture, I don't think we can really separate those two successfully at all. I think they're bound up together in a way that can't really be disentangled. So Shadow is a good example of a dog that has certain instincts, and they are very deeply entrenched. He's an extraordinarily aggressive dog, for example, because of his lineage. He's German, working on shepherd, they're renowned for it. But nurture has sort of softened or moderated him in certain respects. So it's a strange combination, which I've always sort of found fascinating, you know, this combination of aggression and the love of family that he consistently exhibits.
Dr. Mark Rollins, he's been our guest today here on Main Street. His book, The Word of Dog, What Our Canine Companions Can Teach Us About Living a Good Life. Dr. Rollins, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 20th. In January 1857, a survey party left St. Cloud, Minnesota, bound for the headwaters of the Red River. Despite winter hazards, they were determined to beat rivals to the region. The expedition was led by French Chippewa guides Charles and Pierre Botneau. Pierre, known as the Kit Carson of the Northwest, was a famous frontiersman and surveyor. Daniel Johnston, an impoverished schoolteacher from St. Paul, joined the expedition, hoping for riches. He kept a journal of the journey. By January 20th, the group reached the end of the wooded lake country. On January 23rd, they were caught in a blizzard. The tent blew down and the fire went out. The 10-man party slept spoon-style in a large woolen comforter with buffalo robes on top for warmth. Pierre Botineau, singing in his native language, kept spirits up and hunted 2 buffalo. The snow likely saved them from freezing. The crew now faced the open prairie, where shelter and firewood were scarce. Struggling through blizzards, steep snowdrifts, and icy swamps, they reached the junction of the Red, Otter Tail, and Wadasoo Rivers on January 29th, camping at what is now Wells Park in Breckenridge, Minnesota. They began surveying the town site of Breckenridge on January 31st, despite the Dakota people's legal claim to the land. In 1869, Morgan T. Rich squatted there and became known as the founder of Wahpeton, North Dakota. By February, the men had built a log shanty and stable for the oxen. The Botineaus and 2 others returned to St. Paul, leaving 6 men behind to occupy the town sites. They faced harsh conditions, snow, storms, and dwindling food supplies. Their meals of pork, beans, and corn ran out, and they were forced to eat the oxen. In March, the shanty and surrounding area flooded as the snow melted. In April, 1 man left on foot for St. Paul, hoping to survive. He was lost in a blizzard, but eventually reached a farmhouse where his frozen toes were amputated. The crew surveyed 2 more town sites where a railroad was hoped to cross. Supplies and reinforcements arrived in May, but Johnston had lost his passion for town site speculation. By August, he returned to St. Paul to become a newspaper editor. Johnston later wrote, "The medicine I took during 6 months of that year cured me of the townsite speculation fever so completely that I have never felt a touch of it since." Joe Whitford, who had founded Fergus Falls and established a lumber mill in Breckenridge, was killed during the 1862 Dakota conflict. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lee Zerdrick. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, and you can drop us a line here at Main Street. We would love to hear your suggestions for future guests or future topics to discuss. Please email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on Main Street, oncologist and hematologist Dr. Harish Ajha from Essentia Health will be my guest. We'll talk about the complex relationship between alcohol consumption and cancer risk. Our conversation will explore critical questions, including the threshold, if there is one, for safe alcohol use, the types of cancer most strongly linked to alcohol, and the biological mechanisms behind these risks. We'll also discuss how factors like genetics, lifestyle, and public education play a role in prevention, and whether steps like updated alcohol warning labels could make a difference. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.